Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Welcome back. This is Carrie Weber. I'm here with Father Matt Malone and our colleague Ashley McKinless. And we have been talking about the Bishop's Convocation of Catholic Leaders. We've been talking about puppet shows in Gaza. And now we're talking a little bit about something you might have
if
heard.
People are just joining us, they're a little confused about puppet shows in Gaza.
God in all things is the key to understanding America This Week. Yes, Father Matt Malone's reporting trip to Gaza to report on the hope there in the midst of quite a bit of challenge and sorrow. But this weekend was the July 4th weekend we were talking about earlier, and it was kind of an extended weekend for some people, so some folks might be getting back to the office today, and you might have been at Mass on Sunday, hopefully, you know. And in that process, you may have heard a song as an entrance hymn or recessional that was political in nature. And Father James Martin wrote a piece about that that Ashley, you brought to the table today.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about it a bit?
Sure. Yeah, so the piece is, you can find it online. It's Father James Martin, Should We Sing Patriotic Songs at Mass? Probably not. So I guess he kind of makes the whole argument there in the title. But his point was, especially on this Sunday, the gospel was that kind of shocking line from Jesus that whoever loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. So to hear that and then soon thereafter sing a song about loving America was a jarring experience for him. So just got a lot of discussion on Facebook.
People feel like very passionate one way or the other about this.
Yeah. So did you guys hear America the Beautiful at Mass?
No, I was at the convocation.
Oh, okay.
And they did not play any particular political song there. So, yeah, I was not sort of faced with this conundrum this week.
What about the Jesuit community?
We did not sing "America the Beautiful" at our.
All right, two for two,
community.
Ashley.
All right. Well, I was at church in West Virginia, so. They most certainly did sing America the Beautiful, which in principle, I understand Father Jim Martin's point, but in practice, there are very few times when everyone's actually singing at church, and this is one of the few occasions where you can get everyone to.
Yeah, I get that. I get the philosophical argument. I do. Especially songs that are very nationalist and very, like, we are devoted to the country above all. On the other hand, like you said, like, there are so few times to sing any patriotic songs anymore, like, that it's kind of fun, and everybody just kind of sings it.
Yeah.
But, like, is that really, you know, the most liturgically correct thing to do just because it's kind of fun? I don't know.
Yeah. I respectfully disagreed with Father Martin on this matter. I don't actually see the problem with singing a patriotic hymn at Mass on a national occasion. I mean, if you're in, Eloise, who's our producer, is from England, and she'll tell you, like, they get up and sing, I vow to thee my country. Right, it's pretty intense stuff. Also, I have to stand up for America the Beautiful, because Catherine Lee Bates, who wrote America the Beautiful, is from my hometown of Falmouth, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And she would dispute Father Martin's claim that it's not a prayer, or that it is a praise of America. It's actually a prayer invoking God's blessing on America. And when we say, and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to sea, that's a petition.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
And particularly that second verse, which is sung less often, but it's America, America, God mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty and law.
Yeah.
So it's a petition, really, asking God it's not an expression of American exceptionalism. It's actually an acknowledgement that we are a work in progress.
Right, we're not always.
We need God's grace.
Great, and we need some help.
And I think that that's a great thing to acknowledge. So I respectfully disagree with our editor-at-large on this matter.
I'll let you two duke it out back at the office.
I so rarely disagree with him that I thought I, in order to maintain any credibility, I had to publicly acknowledge that I did disagree with him on this occasion. But, you know, I mean, I take his larger point, which is that we should never confuse the nation state and the work of the nation state for the work of the church.
And right. I think there's also some people feel some sense of in praying for America alone, there's sort of an American exceptionalism to that, that where it's like we pray for America because God is on America's side. Like if they kind of like read into it and then think like, well, what about, you know, all the other countries? Do we not bless them? Is that, should we be doing that at Mass too, maybe? And I mean, yes, obviously we should be asking for blessing on all people.
And there's a way in which I suppose we do, right? I mean, the Eucharistic prayer is itself kind of a universal prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's sort of like if you say a prayer with your family for your family, it doesn't mean that you're excluding all other families, right? Or that you think your family's the best or whatever, right? It's I think there's room for both. I think there's room for the both. What do you think, Ash?
No, I agree. Besides the just loving to sing them because they bring me back to elementary school, there are certain ones where it is clearly acknowledging that God has dominion over all of us, and that includes the United
States.
Yeah,
I think some are more troubling than others.
Yeah,
like I wouldn't want to sing the national anthem at Mass.
Yeah.
Or and I do. There is something about something jarring about the symbolism of having a flag near the sanctuary. I don't particularly care for that.
But yeah, and they're all kind of tied together.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, if you're singing that song and there's the flag and, you know, it kind of adds on each other. And so people get understandably a little uncomfortable with some part of it, saying, well, what is our focus here?
Right.
But.
No, I mean, and they're really good questions. And you know who else is great at asking really good questions?
Is it Nathan Schneider?
Right. A contributing writer for America Magazine who has a piece in the June 26th issue of America Magazine.
You're trying to remember where it was. Like, in America? It's in America.
Well, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and the Case Against Philanthropy as We Know It. And Nathan Schneider joins us now to do what he does best, subverting the dominant paradigm. Hello, Nathan. How are you?
Hi. Glad to be back on.
Well, do you want to weigh in here on the patriotic hymns at Mass before we move on to your article?
Oh, well, yeah. I thought you offered a pretty stirring defense there, Father, about for America the Beautiful. It was sung at my church, and I was not enthusiastic about it. You know, I came of age at a moment, you know, right after 9/11, when patriotism was very quickly used to support militarism in response to those attacks. And so, you know, the connection is very close to me, and I appreciate your reasoned response, but my knee jerk is to be very anxious about any kind of connection between the worship of the Mass and patriotism. You know, a song that's been very important to me and that I think would be a beautiful July 4th song is you know, This Is My Song, the Finlandia hymn.
It goes by
a few different names. You know, the song that very explicitly says, you know, my land is beautiful, but so are other lands. And that was, you know, written in the 1930s as the war drums were beating, and is, I think, a hymn that puts patriotism usefully in check, honors our home, but honors others' homes as well.
Yeah, right. That came up in the comments a lot on Father Jim's piece and on his Facebook page, that a lot of people felt really strongly that could be a nice option. And it's a beautiful tune that it's set to.
Yeah, yeah. I actually once sang it at a Mass in Toronto for Canada Day.
Oh,
yeah.
Look at you.
Yeah.
International man of mystery.
Yes, exactly. So, Nathan, as always, you've made a great contribution to the pages of America with this article, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and the Case Against Philanthropy as We Know It. What have you got against Bill Gates and philanthropy? it seems like this is something that's really great, and we could all be cheering.
To me, the question is about what it does to democracy. You know, Bill Gates, I think, arguably is doing a lot of really nice things around, you know, really incredible things as far as saving lives and supporting education in various forms. You know, putting money in places that otherwise might have less money and worthy causes. And so I give him credit for that. But it kind of ends there, and it starts, and I think it raises bigger questions. These are vital, vital sectors of our society, how we heal one another, how we educate our children. And philanthropy ends up being not just a matter of providing more resources to a given activity in a case like Bill Gates's. It becomes a mechanism for determining how those activities are done, to the point where an organization like the World Health Organization, which is an intergovernmental agency, at least partly accountable to government, to democratic governments, essentially is faced with a kind of veto power from the Gates Foundation. If the Gates Foundation doesn't fund an initiative, the World Health Organization can sometimes be kind of dead in the water. And that's a tremendous amount of power that has come to be accumulated by somebody who primarily demonstrated his skill in selling kind of so-so operating systems in very monopolistic ways for many years. So I think it's worth asking why somebody like that should have such power over domains in which he, or I should say they, the Gates family, have demonstrated limited direct expertise. And that extends to much broader range of fields too. And I think it forces us to ask, you know, what is this philanthropy really about? And is this something that we want to encourage as the way things get done in our societies, or do we want to expect more of people who have massive amounts of excess wealth? And actually, I think there's some very ancient teaching in our church that suggests that when excess wealth gets accumulated, it really isn't for the people who accumulate it to determine exactly how it gets dispersed.
Yeah, you go back to the meaning of philanthropy, which is love of people, and loving them means trusting them to know what's best for them. So what do you see as the Catholic groundings of your argument?
Well, it goes back to this idea. It has such a wonderful, wonderful name, the universal destination of goods. And this is a doctrine that you can find in the current catechism, and it also dates back to the earliest formulations of canon law in the medieval period, or early medieval period. And what it says, okay, you know, ultimately God created the world for everyone, for everything. That's kind of Genesis. That's a kind of natural law recognition that God loves us all equally. God created the world for all of us. In some sense, the whole world is all of ours, and all of its wealth is part of that. But the second piece is, okay, but we recognize we live in a fallen world, and private property is a really useful arrangement for encouraging people to be stewards of that world, and to kind of take human failing into account, the ways in which we can't quite manage to act as if all things are common. But there's a corollary that practice of private property must in some sense reflect the recognition that all things are ultimately common. And that puts us into the position of a really interesting debate about what that means. And there's no clear answers. But I do think that in a world where a handful of people own as much wealth as half the population of the planet, we need to think about whether those people really should act as if that wealth is theirs to manage and disperse as they see fit, or whether that wealth should be handled more democratically, whether the means of dispersing that wealth should be more accountable to the to the people whose lives it's going to affect and who don't have the wealth and power make such choices in their own lives and who are going to be impacted by the decisions from on high.
You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We are talking with Nathan Schneider, who is a contributing writer for America, about his recent article, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and the Case Against Philanthropy as We Know It. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of our conversation with Nathan Schneider. Stay with us.
Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Welcome back. You're listening to America This Week. I'm Carrie Weber. I'm here with Father Matt Malone and our colleague Ashley McKinless. And we are speaking with Nathan Schneider, who's a contributing writer for America Magazine. He's also a scholar in residence of media studies at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And he's recently written a really excellent article for us at americamagazine.org called Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and the Case Against Philanthropy as We Know It. So, Nathan, you were talking before the break about needing sort of a new way for people with massive amounts of wealth to use that wealth to help people. But what does that actually look like in reality, in the sort of new vision that you have?
Well, I think that's the conversation that we really need to start having. And I actually think Mark Zuckerberg is a really interesting figure to consider in this respect, because he's also right now following in the footsteps of Bill Gates and in directing his massive wealth toward especially health and education causes. But Zuckerberg has also recently suggested something interesting in a manifesto he posted about the future of Facebook. He suggested that Facebook could help kind of reinvigorate democracy by being more accountable in using new technology to take account for the needs of users and to kind of turn Facebook into a kind of testing ground for new digital democratic tools. And it makes me wonder, why is he not doing that with his philanthropy? You know, when the rubber hits the road, why isn't he allowing people more input in how the wealth he has accumulated might be dispersed? Because these are actually if you even consider Facebook users themselves, these are the people who helped create that wealth. Shouldn't they have some say in what's done with it? And that's just the start of a much broader range of new experiments that are going on around the world. For instance, the government of Taiwan, which is now allowing citizens to comment on proposed legislation through an online platform. There are an incredible number of tools right now that open up new possibilities for participatory debate and governance. And I think that philanthropy needs to take this stuff into account.
Now, do you think that, for example, Mark Zuckerberg's, one of his most famous donations was to the school district in Newark, New Jersey. And Do you know much about how that went down? Because from an outsider perspective, just from 10,000 feet, he gave a lot of money to this particular school district. But how much direction did he give them, or how open was it for them to decide what to do with? And does that violate your philosophy? You know, should he have let Facebook people vote on where the money, which district the money should have gone to? Should have gone to a different foundation? Or is it okay that he chooses one place to give it to?
You know, I don't think I have a kind of rule book to offer. To me, I think what's really missing is the conversation. You know, the conversation around that particular case has tended to revolve around a kind of utilitarian framework. You know, did it work? How many people were helped? In that case, it does not appear to have been successful as hoped. And so the utilitarian response that we tend to have around this conversation was a kind of net negative, you know, like try again next time, better luck next time.
Yeah, I read they spent a lot of money on consultants.
Right.
And trying to tell them what to do with all the money.
You know, and I think, you know, that's fine. And I would have loved to see that, you know, as much as anybody else, love to see that do more good. But I think it's kind of the wrong question to begin with. The question should be more like, you know, what you asked. Is it really fair for him to decide that school district should be chosen? Why was it chosen rather than others? What kinds of strings were attached to that money, whether implicitly or explicitly? And what other kinds of ways could that money be distributed, whether through a kind of participatory thing among Facebook users? Maybe it should just be distributed in a much more blind sort of way, something akin to these ideas about universal basic income, which actually Zuckerberg himself has been more and more an advocate of. And these are just ways of calling into question some of the basic foundations of philanthropic practice. You know, and I start that article with the case of the Frick Museum, which is a pretty museum, a nice museum with lots of nice paintings in it.
But here in New York City.
That's right. But it is worth asking, you know, who is Frick to build that museum? Why is it why are those incredible masterpieces associated with his name? Should they be? Is that an appropriate use of those of that piece of the human inheritance?
Nathan, I'm wondering what you would say to people who might think this sounds nice, but worry that if you put all these strings on what people are doing when they donate money, that they will just hoard it instead and not give it away because they want to see their name on the building.
I think it's a reasonable concern, especially for this new generation that Zuckerberg represents. The Silicon Valley cohort has generally been less eager to give than others have in the past. But I think in a lot of ways they're trying to figure out how to do it right. You know, and one example of a charity that has been quite popular in Silicon Valley and that I think could actually excite more people to give is this organization Give Directly, which just identifies communities in especially East Africa and redistributes the donations that come through the organization as cash payouts to individuals, equal cash payouts. So everybody in a village gets a certain amount of money. And what's built into that is this basic trust that when you give people, especially poor people, money, they do sensible things with it, perhaps more sensible things than a program officer sitting in New York City could think of or something like that. And it's a really exciting opportunity, actually. And I think that if people see the power of a kind of collective and democratic philanthropy, they might actually be more eager to give and more eager to contribute to it, because I think a lot of, especially among younger wealthy people, there's a lot of anxiety about the bureaucracy associated with the philanthropic economy right now.
There was a piece in the Chronicle of Philanthropy not too long ago about the fact that, you know, philanthropists are increasingly, and this is particularly true with foundations, are increasingly, you know, wanting to know what the metrics are for success. You know, when they give a grant to an organization or to an individual, they want to know, how are we actually going to measure the success? And, you know, I'm not opposed to that generally, but it can very quickly devolve into a utilitarian calculus, as you point out, Nathan. And it seems to me that when Andrew Carnegie gave away most of his fortune to build libraries all over the world, like he probably, you know, wasn't like, and I want to know exactly how many people are using this library and you know, on this day and that and so forth and so on. You know, and he probably also saw himself as making an investment in the future that, you know, was in some sense not measurable, because it was as he viewed it, a kind of ennobling act.
Yeah, and there's a way in which democracy creates its own metrics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when some form of governance or power or wealth is accountable to people whose lives it affects, right? It enables them to do two things at once. One, determine their own metrics for what success looks like, and then determine whether that elected official or policy was successful in meeting those metrics. And that dynamic process of democracy is something that I think is more powerful than the kind of top-down metrics that tend to be expected from the utilitarian calculus. So that's, I think, in some ways, the power and potentially the efficiency of this kind of model. This is why giving out money to poor people in Kenya can be more efficient than determining programs that will help them, because actually those people know their needs much better than any outside donor. They know their needs intimately because they live them every day.
So you're not necessarily suggesting that these funds need to be redistributed to government programs, right, per se. You're actually talking about something more radical.
Well, I think that this is an opportunity to recognize that government need not be the only space where democracy happens. And there's probably a useful role for philanthropy in creating non-governmental spheres. And already they've done that. Philanthropy has taken on challenges that governments, for one reason or another, can't. And I think that's worthwhile. But I do think that philanthropy can learn something from the democratic accountability that governments must have. And actually, these could become spaces of experimentation that governments could learn from about new ways of doing democracy that are accountable and more fine-tuned and more efficient and more effective and more actually empowering ways. And there's so many tools out there right now that are experimenting with different ways for people to participate.
Right. You write about a lot of different online communities that are trying this out. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, for instance, a platform called Lumio, which is a decision-making tool that was designed by a worker cooperative in New Zealand. And it's just a simple decision-making tool that enables people to make proposals and vote on the proposal and talk through them. And this has been adopted, and it's been a kind of educational tool for schools, governments, companies all over the world that are learning to do more transparent decision-making through this. Another is Liquid Democracy that's been experimented by among a lot of the new kind of pirate parties emerging in Europe and South America. And this is a tool that enables a kind of interesting balance between direct participation, like in a referendum, which we have a lot of in the United States for state ballot proposals and things like that, and also expertise. So it enables me, for instance, to say, look, I don't know that much about healthcare policy. I'm going to appoint this person to make the decisions. They can use my vote on healthcare policy, but not on anything else. And it's a really interesting way of doing delegation that we haven't really tried out on a large scale before. But these new technologies make it a whole lot easier than it's ever been. And this is only the beginning. I think the opportunities for philanthropy to explore and experiment are tremendous. And again, the fact that they're not just folding into the governmental systems might be a good thing.
I wonder what you would think of online platforms like GoFundMe. There's this kind of shocking report from Bloomberg News last month that said 50% of funds raised on these online crowdsourcing websites go to medical expenses. So it seems like they are becoming kind of like a backup safety net, and they are more democratic, but are they necessarily a good thing for society?
And Nathan, you have about 1 minute to answer that question.
Well, I mean, there is a question, I think, where they're trying to fill in a gap that is very much a public and probably government responsibility, that of providing decent health care. And there I think the responsibility is clear, and in the United States especially, it's a responsibility that has been neglected. Philanthropy is never of the scale to solve the problems of the world, unfortunately, and we can't expect it to.
Nathan Schneider is a contributing writer for American Magazine, and he has published the recent piece, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and the Case Against Philanthropy as We Know It, which you can find online at americamagazine.org. Nathan, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to be on.
I was just out in Nathan's part neck of the woods recently. He's based in Colorado, and I was out there in Aspen for the Aspen Ideas Festival, which is sponsored by the Aspen Institute. And I can see why Nathan is continually inspired with new ideas, because it's a very inspiring place. It's so beautiful out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
An American magazine retreat in Colorado, perhaps, to come up with our editorial ideas.
I'm thinking about it.
I'm in.
I mean, yeah, exactly. We tried to get there this year. We will definitely get there next year, because if we're going to lead the conversation, we might as well do it from the mountaintops.
Why not?
Exactly. So you've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. For all of this content we've mentioned today, you can find it at americamagazine.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Ashley McKinless and Carrie Weber, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.